I talked today about deliverance from Egypt, and I picked that little graphic of the dusty Bible up there because it's something we all need to do. There's nobody in this room or that's listening that doesn't need that that reminder. The most important part of our study and our walk in trying to learn is reading the Bible. Because most people, it's not wrong to listen to somebody else's opinion or listen to a sermon or, you know, go to a Bible study and get ideas from everybody else, and that's a good thing to do. But most people, usually when they come to their conclusions and stuff, it'll be from looking at 90% of it will be some man or some woman's opinion. And then they might check it out and verify it and open their Bible and look at it and say, sure enough, that's what it said. Now, I know for myself, my background is a Seventh-day Adventist, and growing up in the Seventh-day Adventist church, and, you know, we didn't go so much with my mom, but I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, and every Sabbath we were in church. And I wasn't listening that well. Like, church was over at 12 o'clock. And I can remember one time, and I'm looking at the clock on the wall, and it's 12:05. And I'm upset, and they're not even on the closing prayer. And I'm poking my grandma, and I pointed to the clock, and she's, you know, trying to quiet me up. I'm thinking, this guy is talking too long. Doesn't he understand he's supposed to be done at 12 o'clock? There's things I want to do. So I didn't read the Bible that much. And, you know, I would open it up and I thought, well, maybe I should start from Genesis and start reading. And so I'd pick it up and I'd get into Exodus usually. But by the time I was in the Leviticus, I got bogged down. Okay, I just didn't make any sense to me. And then I remember saying, well, maybe we should just read the gospel. So I'd open it up and I'd start in, you know, Matthew. And maybe I'd get through Matthew or, you know, but by the time I was done with Acts, didn't make a whole lot of sense. And I was forcing myself to try and read through it, and it didn't make any sense. So God has to be working with you. He's got to open your eyes up. He's got to be showing you things for it to make sense. I'm not disregarding that. But when he starts to do this, some of the biggest mistakes that people make is just following what other people said instead of what God said. Like that little example I gave last night of, you know, you can't get through the first verse in Genesis, the first chapter, you know, Genesis, the first chapter, the first verse, by the time you read, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, we're already all messed up. Instead of saying, well, who's this God? That's a good question. We automatically assume we know who God is. Say, when was the beginning? People assume those things. Well, it was 6,000 years ago. No, it was millions of years ago. No, it was billions of years ago. And, well, and some say, well, there's this gap time. It was millions of years ago, but then there was, there's this gap in time. So then the story starts this thing. In other words, we all have, before we get through the first verse, we've already made all these decisions instead of saying, well, who's God? That's a good question. I'm going to write that down. When was the beginning? Oh, that's a good question. I'm going to write that down. And he created the heavens and the earth. Well, how did he create it? And what heavens and what earth is he talking about? And then letting him tell us.
Diana always asks the question, where did God come from?
Yeah, where did God come from? See, that's, write it down. That's a good question. But we, you know, even as the Seventh-day Adventists, they hand out their little lesson quarterlies, okay, for Sabbath school. And it tells you what their doctrines and what they believe, and they'll go through the story, and then they'll quote a verse or a couple of verses. And you go back and you look, and sure enough, that's what that verse says. And so you automatically accept the other stuff because that's what that verse says. So they tell you the story. And that's how religion, you know, works. They tell people what to believe. And people will do that. Now, that makes for really good religion, but really bad doctrines and understandings of what God says. Because maybe they're right and maybe they're wrong. Well, they're going to be right on some stuff. But what about some of the stuff that they're wrong on? So we got to listen to it. So we have to be delivered also. We've got to be delivered from our bondage, from our misunderstandings, from our mistakes, from our false assumptions. And if you want to see somebody's opinion, flip it around instead of getting 90% of it from some man or woman's opinion and 10% from God. What would happen if we actually let God tell us 90% and then the things that we really don't understand or can't figure out for sure, we're not sure of, we ask other people and say, what do you think about this? Instead of being 90% deceived, we could be 10%, which is a huge improvement. Okay? So one of the things that we got used to in other groups or whatever, everybody's got these little, let me see if I got mine along with me, which I got to reprint and revise and send out to people. But there's two big changes, and that was this week while we were up here. We walk around with these little pocket calendars, and I might have gave mine away, so I might not have it in here. Oh, yeah, here we go. Everybody's got these little things. Now, most of the people that are here have either from a basic understanding to kind of a detailed understanding of how God's holy days work. I tell everybody, at least in Knoxville, and I've said it at festivals before, what happens if whoever sends these out to you, mails these little things out to you, if something happens, and it's more than just a printer breaks, what if they can't send them out? Do you know how to figure out when God's holy days are? Do you understand what these are? What happens if you can't go down to Walmart and buy a calendar and it says Passover? So, oh, that's when Passover is. Well, most of the time, the little Walmart calendars say Passover. That ain't when Passover is. So do you understand, whatever system it is that you believe in, do you know how that system works? If you don't, I've got good news for you. There's time. Go try and figure it out. Ask questions. Learn. What happens when we don't have access to internet? What happens when you can't call Frank or Herb or Jeff or somebody and say, hey, when's the days of unleavened bread? You know, what I had to do for this? For the one on the internet, we got, you know, out her, well, I think it was, yeah, last fall, Herb and I sat down, and or last spring maybe it was, and we kind of worked it out because I had some different conclusions than he had, and we got together and we said, because we wanted to put up a calendar for everybody. He's already got it on his website, the biblicalcalendar.org. But I'm not sure how far out, but I put one up there until the year 2030, okay? And Herb's got one multiple years out also. So I said, well, we should at least have these things, and, you know, I see this. And so I'm not saying it's possible to get pretty darn good, pretty darn close. But then what about this year? What about this year? What did we do? Mathematically, it should have been a solid sighting in Jerusalem. It wasn't an iffy month, you know, iffy night. It should have been there, unless the weather interferes. Well, guess what happened? The weather interfered, and it changed the day. And instantly people are saying, what are we going to do? Did they see it? You know, all these texts going back and forth and emails and phone conversations and what are we going to do? And my main concern was, well, what are we going to do for all the people? You know, so the conclusion I came to at least is one we've already done many, many times before. Whatever people, first it's between them and God. Right. I'm not the high priest and neither is anybody else that's walking the face of the earth. There's one high priest that we have and, you know, unless I hear this big booming voice and other people, you shall follow the... You know, that didn't happen. I didn't hear. So I says, all right. So we had three Passovers going on, three nights this week. Those that believed that the Jewish calendar is correct, those that thought, well, they should have seen it, so we're going to do it what they should have been. And those that said, well, no, they didn't see it, so it was the 29-day month, so, you know, it slides to a 30-day because it wasn't spotted. And that's mass confusion and wrong, right? Because everybody's supposed to be like a number two yellow pencil. You know, all yellow and all number two, and everybody uses the same sharpener, so they're all the same, and there's no dissent. There's no confusion. There's no misunderstanding possible. Well, like my wife Mary said years ago, and it was over Passover. Do you keep it at the beginning of the 14th or do you keep it at the end of the 14th? And that seems to be a hot subject for a lot of people. And everybody should have an opinion on that. And everybody should do what they believe God is telling them to do. But we shouldn't force people to do it our way. I had one fellow years back, 25 years back, and he was a friend. And he told me, he says, I'm not going to keep the Feast of Tabernacles with you guys. And I said, is there something wrong? I mean, I'm thinking, well, maybe something happened in his life. He's had some calamity, and because he was going to be there. And he's calling me up, telling me he's not coming. And I said, what's the matter? Is there something we can help or whatever? He says, you don't have Passover right. And I'm not keeping the Feast of Tabernacles for you. I says, what does the Feast of Tabernacles have to do with Passover? Right. Oh, come on. You don't keep Passover with us anyhow. Because he lives in another state. And I didn't understand it, but I guess he thought it was a sin because I didn't have Passover right. Maybe he thought he was the high priest. I don't know. And no, I know he didn't. But, you know, we have to have love and compassion and understanding that, like Mary said, maybe God wrote this the way he wrote it and gave it to us in the Bible on purpose. Let me ask a question. Could God have written it so that there is no way to misunderstand how to do it? It's possible. But it's not written like that. Sincere people can come to different conclusions reading the same verses. She said, maybe he did it on purpose to see how we treat each other. To see if we follow Jesus' command to have love for one another and respect. And how do you treat? And who is your neighbor? Well, I guarantee you, we all know the answer to that, but I guarantee you, your neighbors also include your brother and your sister. Now, we can be like a family. Anybody ever see a family that never has any disagreements? The bigger the family, the more disagreements there are. You know, I understand that. I'm kind of like the black sheep, and nobody wants to see me coming. You know, I don't know, maybe I've gone to family before, and I've knocked on their door, and nobody answers, and I'm thinking, are they just hiding, or are they really gone? Well, now they're cell phones, so it's easier. You can just call them up and say, hey, are you home? Your car's out in the driveway. Um, But we got to get delivered out of our Egypt and our ruts. And I'm not saying just make it a free-for-all. And I understand why groups do this. Everybody's the same. And nobody. You got to keep your mouth shut. Because if you don't keep your mouth shut, you're out of there. You're given the left foot of fellowship and invited never to return again. So that keeps it all under control. But I don't think that's the way God works. He chose these things for a reason. Now, 3,500 years ago, God told Moses that he was going to deliver his people from bondage through a series of miracles. Okay? So I got a list of how it started. You know, turning the water to blood. The frogs. The lice. The flies. All the cattle in Egypt die, but none of the cattle of Israel die. The boils. Anybody have a boil? Man, those things are not, you know, it's especially if it's on your... Oh, I remember that one. I've had boils before. I had one on the calf of my leg. I think I've had once or twice I've had a boil. I couldn't sit down. It's on the back of the calf of my leg. I'm, you know, doing this, keep the leg or try and put it on a pillow. That didn't work. You know, imagine being covered with boils. Fire and hail. Locusts. Darkness for 3 days like you can't see the hand in front of your face type darkness. And then the death of the firstborn. You know, something that we all talk about, and it is a big thing. But like it says in Exodus 12, verse 12, it says, "For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, and I will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. Against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt." Protection. Protection from God that the death angel... Now think about it. What if you were the firstborn? Okay? Or your firstborn son, and if you have children, or what if your parents, you know, your father was a firstborn? Everybody's affected by this. There's not a household out there that if it wasn't for God's protection with that death angel, there would have been, even in Israel, death in every household. And all of the death that took place in Pharaoh's kingdom. Now, once Israel gets out into the wilderness, God begins to prepare them for the promised land. And I started thinking, well, you know, I need to pull up this morning. I was going to do this last night, and we got to bed late, and I was really tired, and I got the sermons up on the internet, and I thought, I got to get some sleep. I can't think straight. So I'm going to set the alarm, get up early this morning, which I did. So I started, you know, flipping through and looking up verses and writing it down, and I'm going to, you know, give you all the examples of when Israel is being prepared to enter the promised land. Not the whole 40 years. Just think about this. Just to get them there to the edge and get them ready. And I thought, well, this is going to be long, you know. And so people are going to be getting hungry by the time I'm done with that part. And then that's sort of like the introduction. And so we got to change. So I'm not going to go through all of that. But I encourage people to go through and read it. I've been encouraging you since I started. Blow the dust off the Bible. And I know not everybody's Bibles are dusty, but spiritually, all of our Bibles are dusty because we don't open them enough. Okay, I don't care who you are and how much you study. It's not enough. But he's got them out in the wilderness. He does the miracles. He delivers them out of Egypt. Think about this for a second. Could God have said, just keep marching, like, you know, the Lord's army, march, up, 2, 3, 4, march. Could he have marched them and even supernaturally gave them strength where they weren't tired and they weren't sleepy and they didn't get wore out and they were just marching on over to the promised land? And it could have been a whole lot faster and there was no stops. and there was no experiences that they went through, and you know, they didn't get there 2 days later. Okay, there was a period of time that took place. Why? And it could have been a whole lot shorter. Why did God choose to do it how he did it? One of the reasons, anyhow. I can think of multiple reasons. Why, when he got them there, why couldn't he have destroyed the promised land? There was some plague that had come through and wiped everybody out, and they were all dead. And then the wild animals come in and eat them all up, and they're gone, so there's no mess. You might say, oh, here's an old bone here that, you know, wonder what happened. Looks like a thigh bone or something. He could have done it with a plague, animals to clean it up, or scared them away. You think one angel could have come in and scared them so bad that they would have just run for their lives and flee and never return? He could have done any of those things, but he didn't. Why? Well, one of the things I got to thinking about is, imagine you're a prisoner. Now, everybody knows jails aren't a really nice place, but some of you don't know a lot about me. I've been in jail hundreds of times. I was a jail chaplain for 7 years for Knox County. And I've been arrested a couple other times when I was fighting the government and, you know, wasting my time, but God used that for good. I think I'm, you know, going to fight for the Constitution, and, you know, I sued judges, got a judge removed from office, and I ran for municipal judge for a little town we lived in, lost by, I think it was 47 votes, and the town chairman and board was really worried about that one. And Mary's working for the town chairman, taking care of his mother while all this is going on. But anyway, he let me do what I did because I did not, I still don't like talking. I wish there was somebody else I could have pulled in here for today. But I don't need to get up and talk for my ego, okay? Some people just love it. And some people are really good at it. I really don't think I'm that great at it. But when you're sitting there in front of a judge and he's waiting for you to make one mistake so he can throw you in jail for contempt of court or something, there's nothing people can do to you like that. I was thrown in jail once for contempt of court, but long story, but, you know, I got out in less than an hour, and this thing called habeas corpus. But there's nothing people, the teacher would call on me in school, and it's like, you know, I don't want to talk, I don't want to get up front, I don't want to do the presentation, and that. It's not a big deal now, you know. Is the thing I worry about now is, am I going to say something that will lead somebody astray? Am I going to give them something that's incorrect or wrong? Not about if you guys don't like me. You can throw rotten tomatoes or something. So what? That ain't going to hurt. The only thing you could do that would hurt is if you say, you suck, I'm never going to see you again. You can hurt me like that. But back to this. You're in prison. You've been a prisoner for years through no fault of your own. Maybe like Joseph. No hope of ever getting out. No hope that it's ever going to get any better. You're going to end up dying there, and nobody's even going to come or care. Because everybody you knew and everything you knew is just a memory. But anyhow, after years of hard labor, and even as bad as the prisoners are here, or the prisons are here, it's nothing like, you know, hard labor in Egypt. Prisoners, even in probably one of the worst prisons I can think of, I'm sure Los Angeles is pretty bad, but, you know, like Chicago, places like that, they've got air conditioning. They bring them food, ain't that great of food, but they bring them food 3 times a day. They got a television to watch, card games to play, books to read, time to do, you know. It's not like you're out there in hard labor. People do hard labor to make 11 cents an hour or whatever so you can buy poisonous junk food out of the commissary, things like that. But one day, you got this cruel government authorities that are really torturing and killing some of the prisoners. But then somebody comes along and there's this promise. You're going to be released. This bondage, somebody has taken an interest in you. And this bondage, this torture, these really bad conditions. And some of the other prisoners aren't really that nice either. You're going to be released. They're going to set you free. They're being ordered to set you free. And then it happens. The release comes. They open the doors of the prison, the gates, and they say, you're free. You got the stuff that's your own personal property, and you take it, you throw it in a little duffel bag or a sack, or you put it under your arm, and you walk out, and you're free. And that happens to a lot of people every single day in this country and other countries. But then all of a sudden, it hits you. You're homeless. You don't have a home to go back to. And while you're out walking around, you say, where am I going to sleep? Where am I going to stay? What am I going to eat? What am I going to drink? And you find yourself wandering around, living in a tent, under the stars, and really not knowing what's going to happen from one day to the next. But you were promised this land filled with houses, properties, fields ready to harvest, great prosperity, a promised land flowing with milk and honey, and it was going to be fantastic. But you're walking around and it's hot, and you're sleeping on the ground in the tent. You're lucky to have that, but at least you got that. But there's scorpions and there's all kinds of stuff out there. And water, what are you going to do if you run out of water? Food, you can go hungry a few days and survive, but water, what are you going to do? This is the desert. This is the wilderness. What about this promise? What about this guy that made this promise to you of, like, heaven? You're going to wonder if it's some kind of a trick? You're going to start doubting a little bit and wonder what's going on? And what if, when you find out, oh, it's right over there, go check it out, all you got to do is go in and take it? What if you if there's a chance and you believe that there's this big chance that you're going to lose your life taking the promise that was given to you? When Israel left Egypt, they had spent 430 years there, okay? First, as honored guests, with everything provided for them. And then as time goes on, as slaves, prison camp workers. I don't know what it's like to be in a prison camp. I've talked to somebody, Israel's dad, firsthand, but he didn't, like a lot of people from veterans and stuff from World War II. My grandfather on my dad's side, my grandfather on my dad's side, he was a veteran of World War I and World War II. He lied about his age. He was very young with World War I, and then he was in World War II. He never told me anything about it. He didn't want to talk about it. And I know, like, people that have gone through the Holocaust and stuff, we've We've invited him. One year we had a Holocaust survivor up at Big Ridge for Passover and Unleavened Bread. She came and gave her talk, and she didn't want to talk about it for decades until she realized, hey, there's not many of us left. If I don't tell this story, who is? But as slaves, prison camp workers, these years left them unprepared to accept the promise of the land and anything else, to even have the facilities to go about it. Now, I'm not talking about, I'm going to say something, but I'm not talking down about people that have this thing called a job, a J-O-B, job, all right? Because I've worked for companies and I've been self-employed. But it's a lot harder to be self-employed than it is working for the company. Because you go there and you get a job and they hire you and they tell you when to show up, when to go home. A lot of them, what to wear, whether it's some certain office dress code or it's in a factory and you got to have these steel-toed safety shoes and the safety glasses. And they tell you everything you're supposed to do. And they tell you what to do when you show up. And you can get in a rut like that. Okay? And it's what a lot of people want, desire. And the first real, well, I've had jobs since I was, you know, I was working in junkyards when I was in the summer when I was 13. My parents' friends owned a junkyard. So, you know, I've had those. But the first job I had in a decent factory, international company and all that, I thought, wow, they're paying me good money. And I thought, I'm going to work here my 30 years and then I'm going to retire and draw my pension and my life is set. And that worked good for about a year and a half or 2 years, and then the economy came along and next thing I knew, I was laid off and didn't have a job. What am I going to do? And it's hard. So the first thing I'm doing is I got to get a job. I got to have, I don't know what to do. I need somebody to tell me what to do. So you can get into this rut. And that all, Israel never made a choice. They were told what to do, when to do, how much material they were going to get to do what they were supposed to do given their quotas. And basically when you go through that for multiple generations, everybody has that, you know, where's your taskmaster? Where's the pharaoh? You're trying to figure out maybe ways to make it a little easier on you, but basically all the decisions are made from where do you live to and everything in between. So there's miracles going on. Everybody, I'm sure, reads about all of the things, say, how could the doubt happen? How could they be questioning things out in the wilderness, challenging Moses and complaining about God? And what did he do? Just bring us out here so that we could die? When those miracles, you were alive. It's one thing to read them, but you actually saw them take place. The water, the manna, the pillar of fire by night, which keeps you warm. I've never been in a desert before, but I understand at night it gets cold. So you can see a little bit. It's going to provide light. You can say, hey, there he is, right there. Everybody can see him. You get the warmth. Everybody, what happens when you get a campfire? Everybody stands around the fire and, you know, warms your hands and it feels really good. It's doing multiple things. And then during the day, the cloud, I guess it could get hot. Now, Frank, you showed some of those pictures. Looked like it could get hot during the day. You got shade. And then what are you going to eat? You got manna. What are you going to drink? He provides water, whether it's cleaning up, you know, throw this stick in here and clean this up so it's drinkable, or just comes out of a rock enough to feed to satisfy millions of people. But I can see people, you know, they'd be complaining, water? I like lemonade, or I like Coca-Cola. You know how long it's been since I've had a Coca-Cola? Now, they didn't have Coca-Cola there, but they had other things. Maybe the slaves even got a beer every once in a while, because Israel had beer. It's hot out here. You know how long it's been since I've had a good beer cooled off in the stream and, you know, complaining. Is it structured water? Is it reverse osmosis or distilled? Is it mineral water? What's the pH? We would all be complaining about something. Let's be honest. We'd all be bellyaching about something with all those miracles still going on. But when you get into that mindset, you can only see the negative and none of the positive. There's a reason I'm bringing it. A lot of you have already figured it out. But anyhow, when they finally get to the land that God promised them, he says, all right, take 12 of your leaders, one from each tribe, and go in there and check it out, see what it is I'm about to give you. Okay? 40 days later, these guys return, and 10 of them are saying, oh, it's true. They bring produce to the land back. It's true. Look at the size of this. It is everything God told us is the land filled with milk and honey, and it's fantastic. There's only one problem. Those people are going to kill us. They can squash us like bugs. There's no way. And you got two say, no, wait a minute. God promised us this. But the 10 won out in the people's eyes versus the two. The giants and the walled cities. God was offering them to him. He says, here it is. Go take it. In other words, they had to go in and do something. He didn't clear it out with a famine, with a plague, or have one angel go in there and scare the daylights out of them and they all go off running. He chose to do it the way. Was it a mistake? He didn't know what was going to happen. Oh man, these stupid people, there goes my plans all messed up. Maybe he had a plan. Okay? Maybe he knew what was going to happen. You think it's possible the one that knows the end from the beginning? The one that knows your name before you were ever formed in the womb? The one that chose you before the foundations of the world was laid? That maybe he has the plan? But because of their lack of faith, disobedience, not trusting him in spite of all of the miracles that happen, they end up wandering through the wilderness for 40 years. That cruel, heartless, evil God took vengeance upon them and made them all rot out in the wilderness, waited for all of them to die except for two. And then even Moses, right before he takes them up on the mountain, he says, there it is, see it? You're dead. Boy, isn't it great that we get to worship Jesus, you know, and the little baby in the manger, and, you know, kumbaya and love and happiness and feel good religion, and, you know, we don't have to deal with that father guy, and, you know. No wonder the false religions all fall for that and don't understand. During those four decades, one thing happened. And it wasn't instant, but over time, people learned to trust and have faith. There was other things going on, but that's one thing that was accomplished. People learned to trust and have faith in God. Even though they didn't trust God enough to receive his gift, he continued to bless them and provide for them. Miracles, like 40, anybody got a pair of shoes that they've worn for 40 years and they're not wore out? They're still in good shape? I don't think I got any 40-year-old shoes laying around anywhere. But if I did, I wouldn't want to put them on my feet. If I found a pair from long ago, you know, who knows what, wonder how they'd smell. You know, You're going to put that on your foot. But eventually, through trusting God and obedience and accepting the promise, I don't think, there's no record of it anyhow, when he finally said, go in now. Now he says, I ain't going. I'm fine where I am right now. I got everything I need. I got manna to eat every day. Everything's provided. I don't think anybody refused to obey this time, to have trust this time. Maybe there was this, what do you think is going to happen? Well, you want to stay here? Aren't we better off just trusting God and going in and doing what he says? But they all went in. And as long as the children of Israel obeyed, they thrived with wealth and prosperity. Now, I'm not this wealth and prosperity preacher, and you got to have faith. You got to have, you know, Maserati faith. You know, quit having faith like a Chevy. You don't have... Israel, get that plate and pass it. If you don't have money in your bank account, that's all right. Have faith. Just write that check out. God will provide. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. That name it and claim it and that kind of nonsense that goes on. I'm talking about as long as Israel obeyed and had faith in God, they were blessed. Beyond abundance. He provided not only their physical needs, but their spiritual needs. Today, what's all that got to do? You know, that's 3,500 years ago. That's a long time. How are we going to put this together for our life? How are we going to make it real? How are you going to relate to kids and try and tell them this? How are you going to relate to other adults and get them to understand this? Because it's one thing to read about it and see what they did, but what about us, you and me individually? How's that supposed to help us? How are we supposed to get something out of it? How are we supposed to be delivered from our bondage, from our Egypt? Because we're all in it, we're all living in it, and we're all experiencing it. Anybody here have no doubts at all? Never questioned at all? Never got down on your knees and said, God, what's going on here? I don't understand. Please give me understanding. This isn't the way I would fix this. Don't you know I need a job? Don't you know I got to have food? Don't you know that I have responsibilities? I have children to take after, or I have my parents are older and I've got responsibilities there. Don't you see this? I'm faithful. I'm doing what you say. What's going on here? And we ask all these, and even if you're not brave enough to get down and do it in prayer, you've got these thoughts going on in the back of your head and wondering what's going on. But today we're living in a time like the world has never seen before. Now I know people have been saying that for centuries and centuries, but it hasn't seen anything like this before. And I used to read the Bible, and I'm not setting dates and making all the mistakes, and, you know, I couldn't even figure out the date to set it, to be honest with you, okay? I'm pretty good at math, but I ain't that good. And even if I was, you know, a PhD mathematician, a professor somewhere taught math, and, you know, the calculus and the trigonometry that I took 30, almost 40 years ago, I forgot. I remember when Kathy, trying to help her with geometry, I had to say, oh, man. And now with new math, you can forget it because 1 plus 1 doesn't equal 2 anymore. But back to this. We are living in a time when governments treat their people with extreme cruelty, mistreat their people. Why would they do that? Why would China lock things down? People, at the beginning of the week, I haven't watched TV all week. It's great. Haven't listened to the news on the radio. It's fantastic. But people in China are jumping out of buildings to their death because they're locked down and they're hungry and starving. Why would a government intentionally do that to somebody? Why would a government take people and brainwash them and coerce them and force them to take some kind of toxic substance that's experimental that I believe they know is very dangerous and inject it into their bodies that will do long-term damage and kill their own people? It's sort of, you know, a farmer wouldn't go out there and say, I'm going to do an experiment here. I wonder what level of strychnine my cattle can live with. So let's just ramp it up slowly. Or, I got an idea. Next time I have the vet out here and we inoculate all of them, we'll just mainline some strychnine right into them. A substance will alter their DNA so it produces strychnine. And let's just see who dies and who doesn't. And then you got all kinds of, they would never do anything like that. You're some wacko conspiracy theorist, nutcase, crazy, stupid idiot for even believing that. Okay, then it's all a mistake. And they're incredibly stupid and inept and incompetent. But I don't believe that either. They're smart people. They're doing whatever's going on, and not just that, but in every form of government, it's being done on purpose, from destroying the economy, from robbing the wealth from the people and taking it for themselves. So doesn't God see what's going on? It's like, hey, you see what they're doing to your children? Some of us actually love you and know who you really are. Do you see what's going on here? What are you doing? What are you allowing this? Guess what? Everything is exactly on plan and exactly following the timeline. And even if you understand and you know exactly what's going on and you figured it out, and what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? If you are really successful enough to actually get other people to see and understand these things, without his protection, you know, I used to call it a case of Arkanside. You're going to wind up dead. When Bill Clinton was president, you're just going to wind up dead. Worst case of suicide we ever saw, 37 bullets to the back of the head. You're just going to disappear. You're going to have a plane crash. They're going to turn their scalar technology on you, and you're going to get eat up with cancer or a heart attack and fall over dead or whatever. They got plans for you if you're successful enough. Unless God protects you, what are you going to do? And how are you even going to do something for your own family? What major change can you... We can't. What are you talking about? I bought some land out in the middle of nowhere, and I ain't bugging in, I'm bugging out. I've got 7 years of plenty stored up in all kinds of precious metal, lead. You're going to do it on your own. God's going to let you do it on your own. And I think I can tell you how that's going to turn out if you're doing it on your own and not relying upon Him. But we all got this mentality, and I call it, and I'm not trying to be racist or anything, but I call it ghetto mentality, because there's every nationality in the ghettos. And the people in the ghettos can't, some of them do. They get out. They escape. They're freed. But it doesn't matter if you're white, brown, black, multiple generations. If you grew up in the ghetto, and your mama grew up in the ghetto, and your grandma grew up in the ghetto, and even if dad and granddad was there, or if he, in some cases he won there, guess what the chances are that's going to happen with you? Unless there's an intervention. Unless there's something inside of you that says, no, Teach me thy ways, O God. But we all have this ghetto mentality to some sense, living in this world that we're all experiencing now. And a lot of times it's hard to see something other than the negatives that are going on, because there's a whole lot of negatives going on. You don't have to look far to see all of the negatives, to start questioning what's going on and what's going to happen, to praying and, you know, deliver us from this stuff. We have this promise. We got a promise, and I'm not talking about, you know, for the closing hymn today, we're going to sing All Fly Away. All Fly Away. You know, we're going to all go get raptured, or we're all going to go off to heaven, and we're going to live in the land. We're going to sit on the cloud, like the Seventh-day Adventists would tell us. We're going to go to heaven for 1,000 years, and you're going to sit on a cloud, and you're going to drink milk and eat honey, and it's going to be perfect, and everybody's going to be happy, and there's no sin, and there's no suffering and disease. And I'm thinking, you know, as a little kid, I'm thinking, well, I like a glass of milk every once in a while, but I don't want to live just off of milk. And honey is good for sweetening things, but at that time, I like sugar a whole lot better. You know, what happened to the sugar? And if honey is going to be your food, you're going to get sick of that stuff after a while. So you're going to wash it down with a glass of milk. That didn't sound like such perfection and, you know, but they got people convinced, and we're going to fly away, and we're going to live in a promised land of milk and honey. But God has made real promises to each and every one of us. And we all got an idea of what they might be, or our interpretation from His Word of what we're going to be doing. And so religious organizations come up with all kinds of theories. Well, you know, it's going to be like the army. You're going to be captains over 100 and captains over, you know, so, okay, I'm going to be a soldier in God's army. And we all come to these conclusions, but the bottom line is God has promised us happiness. Okay? Everybody wants to be happy, even the people that are never happy, no matter what. And you think that they don't want to be. Everybody really wants to be happy. But are we willing to trust God with our life? Do we see only the negatives? Do we only have the lack of faith? I'm not talking about to wonder what's going on. I'm talking about you don't believe God because you won't do what He actually says you need to do. I've been in that case before. I've been in that situation. I'm not saying, oh, someday you will achieve, you know, perfection and these things won't bother you and you won't have a second thought. All of us. It's called a trial for a reason. A temptation for a reason. If it wasn't tempting, it wouldn't be a temptation. Let's get real and be honest. Are we willing to trust God with everything? Do we have that kind of belief? Are we willing to do anything He asks? Make sure it's Him that's asking. But if it is, are you willing to do whatever it is? Or are we afraid and we complain because we don't see things going the way we think they should? Like Frank pointed something out yesterday. Okay? Read another verse here. Numbers 33:11. They moved from the Red Sea and camped in the wilderness of sin. Are we camped out in our wilderness of sin? And that's all we see. And that's all we comprehend. Are we ready to believe and prepare to enter in to the promises that God has given us? What was the thing that kept Israel from receiving God's promises? What was the number one thing?
Unbelief.
But why did they have unbelief? The number one thing that kept them from entering into the wilderness was faith. Anybody here, don't raise your hand, but anybody here that God's never done anything for you? There's never been any miracles? Huh? You're lucky to be here, and it's only through your own strength that you were able to accomplish it. He's done nothing in your entire life for you. Well, if you think that, guess what? You just don't see it. You really don't. When we get trials, are we like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? See, I read these things and I've got a little streak of rebelliousness in me, and it's to my own detriment, okay? Sometimes it gets me in trouble. But are we willing to even do what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did? Everyone was commanded to fall down and worship Nebuchadnezzar at the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, and the psaltery. We all know the story. You know, I got the verses up there, but we already know what happened and what it says. What if it was you? What if it was you? And maybe it wasn't fall down and worship, but it was something else that caused you to violate what God says to either do or not do. You had to make a choice. God or Biden or whoever. Putin, you know, wherever it is you live. Because he was the king. Nebuchadnezzar's the king. He's the government. He's the much more powerful than Biden or Trump or anybody that the president we had. Guess what happens if he don't like you? Off with your head or into the fiery furnace. In Daniel 3:19 it says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression of his face changed towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." In other words, he was ticked off, mad. Okay? "He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated." That was strictly for pure terror. What difference does it make physically if they throw you in the fiery furnace? You go, psh, right. Or you go, psh. Does it really matter? In fact, it's a blessing if it's 7 times hotter, because it ain't going to hurt as long. As he commanded, verse 20, "As he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down and bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste, and he spoke, saying to his counselors, 'Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?' They answered and said to the king, 'True, O king.' 'Look,' he answered, 'I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the form of the fourth one is like the Son of Man.'" And he tells them to come out. Now, you know the difference between those three and me? I would have said, "Why don't you come on in, king, and get us?" Okay, so maybe because of my rebellion and my arrogance and my, you know, maybe God would let me go, you know. But in essence, what was going on, that's what God was showing. You can't hurt my people without my permission. You can do anything you want. But they had the fiery furnace to scare everybody else into submission. Maybe they were the only three, it doesn't tell, but maybe they were the only three that refused to bow down and worship. Then, we're given another example. How many of us are willing to be like Daniel? I'd rather be thrown into a fiery furnace than thrown into a den of lions and get torn to pieces. That's going to hurt a lot longer than go, psh. But in Daniel 6, verse 7, says, and the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and the satraps, the counselors and the advisor have consulted together to establish a royal statute and make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now remember, why did they hate Daniel's guts? Why did they develop this scheme and plot against him? Because he was a righteous man. He wasn't doing anything. He's not like a politician today. He wasn't doing anything that was wrong. He was a righteous man. He was a man. The only way we can get him is through this God that he worships. We got to figure out how to come up with a way. You think that that's a possibility that something like that could happen soon? Or is happening today? Verse 8, now, O king, establish a decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree, and when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open, he hid in his prayer closet and prayed. Right?
Yeah.
No. He opened the windows so that everybody could see what he was doing. Says he knelt on his knees with his windows open towards Jerusalem. He knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Not only, could he have gone into a prayer closet? Yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to compromise one inch when it comes to God. That was Daniel's opinion. In fact, I want everybody to see, and Daniel wasn't some insignificant. That's why they hated his guts. Because of his relationship with God, he had found favor with the king. You know, they wanted to set him up. They wanted to take him out. What do we do with our jobs and our taskmasters when they order us to violate God's commandments? His instructions. Do we compromise and conform to the world? In John 16:31, Jesus answered them, do you now believe? Indeed, the hour is coming, yes, has now come, that you will be scattered, each to his own, and will leave me alone. And yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Wow, isn't it a fantastic thing that only that, you know, the disciples had to worry about that, but we don't. There's no tribulation in our life. There's nothing to overcome in the world. But we do have that same promise. Do you have the Father? Because without him, you're not going to get through that tribulation. Do you have faith? Or are you walking around with a ghetto mentality? When things don't go as we understand, when God's plan comes into conflict with our plan, do we understand? Do we know? Do we believe that our Father's with us too? Frank talked about God providing and spending his last 10 cents for a bag of popcorn for Diane yesterday. And all he had to do was take a job and work on Saturday. He had offers. He had jobs. But you're down to your last 10 cents. Are you willing to do that? Now, maybe you don't have to, whatever the best way to get you, if it's your family, Satan will use your family to get you to compromise. If it's your job, guess what he's going to use? Your job. If it's your possessions, your house, your cars, whatever it is, your boat, whatever it is, What is Satan going to use to try and get you to fail? Whatever your weakness is. I don't know how long I've gone, so I'm going to make this really super short. This isn't a story about Mark, but I'm going to show you about sometimes in our unbelief, he still comes in and rescues us. I've told this story before, but, you know, I've had, felt like it was only on paper, but I've had on paper where I was worth some money, and then I've been dirt poor and have nothing. Where I got to sell everything I have, sign my house away because I can't make the house payments. Wonder, am I, you know, have a plan. I'm going to go down to Walmart and I'm going to buy a tent. And I ain't living under a bridge. I'm going to find a field with some trees in it so I can get some shade and close where I can walk up. And if I have to, I can go dumpster diving and, you know, get some food, some toxic waste. You know, I hope that the ravens just bring me some food. But if they don't, I got to make sure that there's dumpsters around there. I can do dumpster diving. That's my plan. But my business partner is over at our house. He used to run a business out of a house we had in Wisconsin. He's hanging around. I thought he was only going to be there a couple hours in the morning, and here it is. Spent several hours, and I'm getting hungry. It's like 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I asked Mary, I said, what do we got to eat? And she tells me, she says, take a look. And I open up the cupboards. People say, well, I have nothing to eat. Guess what was in the cupboards? Nothing. I mean, not like cans of food that you really don't want or don't like. There was none. And I look in the refrigerator, and you know those little, they look like a lemon little jug thing, and you can take water and squeeze it in there, and you can make lemonade, right? She had a jug, like half a little jug of that, of 4 or 5 ounces of that. And open up the freezer, and there was a half of a bag of French fries in the freezer. And nothing else, one thing in the freezer, some French fries, and then that little jug, no food of it, you know, other than the French fries and nothing else. And she says, how long is he staying? But she made that afternoon, and we ate that, and that was the last food that we had. There was nothing. So that, you know, it's like 5 o'clock or so, and she comes out. I'm just sitting on the porch, and I'm wondering, what am I going to do? You know, I have screwed up so bad because here, there's nothing in the house to eat. What am I going to do? This is on me. And she says, what are we going to do? Like, I wasn't thinking about that, you know. So I come up with this plan. I know what we're going to do. And many of you know her. I says, her sister Linda. I says, let's go over by Linda and Tom's house. She's going to be making supper, and she's going to have some food going. And had a little bit of gas, about a quarter tank of gas in the car, and it was only about 6 miles or so. I says, let's jump in a car and go over there. We'll look really hungry, and she'll feel, what are you guys doing for supper? She'll invite us, and problem solved for today. I don't know what we're going to do in the morning, but they'll feed us today and the kids. And shortly after I tell her, let's go over by Linda and Tom, some friends of ours that we hadn't seen in almost a year pulled up our driveway with their car. And I thought, wow, they were friends. There was stuff going on in their life, and you know they were off fighting the government and doing things too. But went up there, and Roy got out of the car, and he came up to me. He says, how's everything going? And I says, oh, all right, pretty good. And he said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, we're okay. And he said, no, for real, Mark, you can tell me. How's everything going? And I said, okay. And he says, I don't understand. He says, what do you mean? Well, about a year before, they had quit going to the Baptist church. Okay, they learned about the Sabbath. He He says, for the last year, we've been saving our tithe, not knowing what to do with it. And today we woke up, and God told us to go out and buy food and take the rest of it and bring it to you. He says, come look in my car. The back seat, up to the back seat, the floor, it was full of groceries. He popped his trunk open. It was full. And he had to push on the trunk to get it closed. And then he pulled a stack of money out and he says, I don't understand. I know he told me to do this. I started crying and I said, come into the house. And I opened up the refrigerator and the freezer and there was nothing in there. And I opened up the cabinets and there was nothing in there. And I'm trying to figure out on my own how I'm going to take care of this. Now, because of my rebellion and my stubbornness and, you know, that stiff-necked and hard-headed and, you know, I'm going to fight you type mentality. I'm not a tough guy or anything like that, but I'm pretty darn stubborn. God let me not get to the edge of the cliff. I was over the cliff and I was hanging on by my fingernails. And they were breaking off one at a time and they were getting pretty weak and tired and I was about ready to drop. And he let me get to that point before he let me understand, I got this. I'm going to take care of this. And in ways I never dreamed or imagined either. See, we had other things coming up, like they're going to shut the electric off, you know. We hadn't made a house payment, and you don't make enough of those, then pretty soon get out, that type of thing. But there are things he's done. Now, it's not been smooth and easy and, you know, no trials and tribulations since that time 40 years ago. But I know that even when things aren't going according to Mark's plan, he's in charge. So I keep saying, it's right on time, everything's on plan, and it's happening exactly according to what he wants. We just don't understand it, but maybe we need to let go of some of these questioning and unbelief and have a little bit more faith and ask them to show us. If it's possible, if it doesn't screw us up too bad, could you please let me know what's going on here? Or at least what I should do next. Do we really believe what Jesus said? Let's take a look at this. Luke 12, verse 4, it says, and I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body, and after that they have no more that they can do. In other words, they can strap you down and inject you with anything. But if it actually comes to that, you know what? God's stronger than Big Pharma. Yeah. Okay? Right. Even if they kill you. I don't know, you know, nobody's ever had the power to kill me. That was in authority. I mean, there's other people that have killed me, and if they would have had a gun, wanted to kill me, if they would have had a gun or something, they could have. But I knew it'd say, well, you can't get away with it, even if you can try, but I think I can take you or whatever. But I'm talking about standing in front of somebody in authority that actually can kill you, and there's absolutely nothing that you can do about it. What if that happens? Now, you know, I like the verse in Psalms where it talks about go into your house in secret. Well, basically, the missiles and the bombs and the search and helicopters with the infrared searches and stuff, they're looking, and you're hiding in secret. That's what I hope my fate is. I want to go into my own comfortable house and hide while the stuff hits the fan, okay? But what if it's not? What if that's not God's plan? What are we going to do? Are we going to compromise? You know, Israel's dad, he was in a prison camp in Romania for 5 years. They had him lined up on a wall with guns pointed towards him. He wouldn't work on Sabbath. He wouldn't swear allegiance to the state. That's something, they can pull the trigger and kill you. And he told them, I don't care if you shoot me, I'll never do this. Now, hopefully nobody else that I know ever has to face anything like that. Hopefully we don't have to face anything like that. But what if we do? What if I show, verse 5, but I will show you whom you shall fear. Fear him, after he has killed, has the power to cast into hell. Yes, I say to you, fear him. In other words, fear God. Like Charlie Kimbrough used to say, and I didn't understand it the first few times I heard him say it, but he says, they can kill me, but they can't eat me. Now, for him, that must have been the most terrible thing, like, you know, cannibals get him in Papua New Guinea and kill him and eat him or something. He was willing to die, but he didn't want to get eaten. You know, so something similar like that. Verse 6, are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 copper coins? You know, comparison, say, look at the sparrows. They're really not worth that much in the scheme of things. But they're part of God's creation. And not one of them is forgotten before God. We know these verses. But do we really put it together with our lives? Verse 7, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. Now, some people it's easy to count. But I think he knows the hair follicles that aren't sprouting no more and producing anything. He knows how many of those are in your head. And not only how many hairs are in your head today, if it's growing thin or it's bald up on top or whatever, but how many you had when you were born. He knows every little single thing about you. And if he closed the fields with the lilies and, you know, the produce and the plants, and he provides for the sparrows, you think he doesn't have our needs in his mind of what it is that we actually need? And what we're actually not want. We all have wants. I'm talking needs. First, one last scripture. Exodus 14:10. When it looks like there's no hope and God has abandoned us, are we ready for this? What are you talking about? Are you ready for it? I'll tell you when we get there. Verse 10, Exodus 14:10. And Pharaoh drew near, and the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid. In other words, they needed to change their pants. Think about it. If it's you, and you're trapped, there's nowhere to go. And here comes the National Guard, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, the Secret Service, and everybody else that they can muster, and they're after you, and there's nowhere to go. They were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told? This is not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Verse 13, and Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. Are you willing to do that? Certain, it's a mess. It's terrible. I'm not even talking about dying, because that's not what it takes, death, to get God's people to compromise. Are you willing to stand still and see the salvation of the Lord in your life? Where it looks like there's no way this has gone down good. But what if it doesn't? What if it's his plan that you got to go through something that you really isn't pleasant? You ever go through something and wonder, why did God allow this? Man, it would have been so easier if he would have intervened and answered my prayers. Why did I have to go through this? And then later on, maybe even years later, I think I know now. I think I understand now. Are we ready to stand still and see the salvation of the Lord that He's going to accomplish for us, especially the longer it is, the worse it's going to get, and the more miracles we're going to see, and the more intervention we're going to see, and the more God should become real to us, are we going to be like, let human nature get us, let Satan whisper into our ear, let us have doubts? Are we going to be ready to be delivered from our Egypt, from our sins? Are you going to succumb to the temptations and the weaknesses and the doubts and the lack of faith and the unbelief and the uncomfortableness? It says, the end of 13, it says, "For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see no more forever. The Lord will fight for you and you shall hold your peace." So we all got to understand. I said, you know, you can bug out and have all the precious metals you want and all of the long-term food storage you want and do it on your own. And yes, be smart. And if you are, be a little bit like Joseph, if it's in your ability. Because you might not only need to help yourself, maybe God's given you something so that you can help somebody else also. Like He gave to our friends up in Wisconsin, who we hadn't even seen for a year. It would have been very easy for them to say, we ain't seen Mark in a whole year. What are you talking about? Take this money and go out and actually do something. You know, can't we just write them a check and mail it to them? No. Get in your car. Go down to the grocery store. Fill up your car with food and whatever's left over. Then go over there and give it to them and tell them who told you to do this. That's the important part. Who told you to do this? We're living in a time where we're going to see the salvation of the Lord. Are we ready? Do we have that kind of faith? Are we going to be delivered and get God's promises? Or are we going to be weak? What if it's your children? What if it's your wife or your husband or your parents? If you turn your back on God and throw your lot in with Satan, are they really going to be better off? Is it really going to be the best thing for them? Thank you.